Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled The Piper at Hanging Rock Gate. This talk is delivered by Dr. Xavier Catania.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. We welcome you back to the 14th annual seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. And we're starting off the new year with a talk by Dr. Xavier Catania of the Center of Communications Technology. We have just been watching with Xavier his excerpts from the famous classical Australian film Picnic at Hanging Rock. And we now welcome Dr. Catania to talk about the film and give us his arguments about the film. Xavier, thank you.
The glasses at 60 years of age. As of course you do know, it's the paper is titled The Hanging Rock Piper. Where? Lindsay. The original author of the original Australian novel, John Lindsay, and The Spectral Fluidity of Nothing. I start with the epigraph is taken from Lindsay's book. And this is what it says. Nothing in life was really watertight. It is an axiom of film criticism that no single interpretation of Peter Weir's Picnic at Hanging Rock can resolve its insoluble mystery, or what Gary Hensel labels its plot's, quote, central absence, unquote. Everett Eugene Corum concurs, adding that picnics, quote, unclosable situation, is a result of the director's ambiguity about the events and the metaphors used to describe them, unquote. But as Corum rightly observes, Weir's is a, quote, tantalizing ambiguity that opens picnic to possibilities of interpretation, unquote. Consequently, given that Weir himself contends with David Castell that, quote, the film is as good as one's own imagination, unquote, one could possibly shed some mythic light on its puzzling proceedings by interpreting them through Marek Haltov's suggestion that Hanging Rock is not only, quote, a sacred original ground, but a symbol of ancient knowledge in this context comparable with Aboriginal Dreamtime, unquote. Worth quoting here is Stephanie Gaupier's defining admonition. And I'm quoting, of course, Stephanie Gaupier. Our term, dreamtime, is a misnomer. For the Aborigines, define being in terms of place and space rather than time. Dreaming is not a time, but a symbol, a location, and a source of energy. Intrigued by what Gaupier calls, by Gaupier's earth forces, this is her phrase, whom she sees claiming Weir's schoolgirls, this paper attempts to chart the latter's hypothetical trajectory in terms of, thanks to you, Antero Ali's Hellenic twisting of dreamtime into an Aboriginal Neptune, whose constantly shifting waters, obliterating, and I'm quoting, all sight and perspective, liquefy the abductees into a state of sightless navigation, unquote. Hence Weir's cryptic landscape with its unfathomable fluidity seeping through what Jonathan Rayner aptly describes as a collage of, and I'm going to quote, time lapse, slow motion, unexplained voiceover, and omnipotent revelation. Just as thematically crucial, however, is the equally intriguing possibility that Weir, inspired by John Lindsay, transmutes his aboriginal fluid demon into a Dionysic genius loci. For what John Kirkby animistically terms Lindsay's Forsterian earth spirit, that is her phrase, an invisible living force lurking in numinous haunts like the Malabar Caves and Hanging Rock, becomes in such classical readings panically suggestive. Donald Barrett, for instance, conceives Lindsay's rock as, quote, a metaphor for Pan, unquote, and hence held happily art picnickers as implicit victims of this Arcadian nymph abductor. So does Carolisa V. Hartigan, who likewise senses the goat god, casting his spell, that is, of course, her words, upon Weir's counterparts through the haunting notes of the pan pipe. Again, those are her words. Significantly, while the typically enigmatic Lindsay refrains from corroborating Barrett's pan interpretation, she readily endorses Weir's choice of Georges Zamfir's Flute de Pan as appropriate film music. And I actually quote her in the endnotes. Such an approval indicates that Lindsay concerns herself less with Barrett's query about her alleged pan novel, and I'm quoting Barrett, giving no hint of pan the musician, than with her feeling that the film's pipe music is emotionally congenial to what she calls the fatal picnic. But Weir's vision crucially transcends Lindsay's, for his equally hoofless piper turns the redeemed screw on her immaterial entity by spectralizing into the ghostly eruption of non-diegetic piping. Michel Chion's concept of the filmic acousmetre, or acoustical phantom, becomes in Picnic a subject of uncanny variation. For by being absently present in Weir's visual oral diegesis, the piper mutates into what Derrida would call, his famous phrase of course, a ghost of the ghost, shedding even the rock's dreadful shape, and I'm quoting Lindsay here, lumbering across Lindsay Schoolgirl's visionary plane. Weir's impalpable piper waxes and wanes in an extra-diegetic soundscape of flutings that fades into a realm of the inaudible. Weir's Picnic recreates Lindsay's Terra Incognita Australis as an out-of-filmic text, beyond what is seen and heard. The visual, oral or chant, is virtually its fantastic territory. But this statement can be viewed into a perspective if we analyze in detail how Weir transcribes the aboriginal dreamtime ideas from which Haltoff sees Lindsay molding her enchanted characters into a filmic insubstantiality of spectral sounds and silences. Weir's opening sequence offers an evocative example, for Hanging Rock's mystery dissolves, immerses us at once into its metamorphic might, or to use aboriginal terminology, its fluid dreaming, that constitutes its potency as an earthly location. Significantly, the piper flutes into this landscaped liminality when Hanging Rock intermeshes with wind-blown scourge nettles, echoing the aboriginal didgeridoo by likewise evoking through its resonance what Marge Kibbe and Carl Neuenfeld label a sense of, and I'm quoting them, primitive spirituality in an exotic landscape, unquote. The flute de pan resoundingly connotes that the piper is Hanging Rock's woodwind response to an equally fluid force, Miranda's voiceover identification with Poe's self-tormented soul. Admittedly, Miranda never mentions such epithets in her quotation, nor any references to Poe's pitiless wave, and that's of course Poe's words, those are Poe's words, that liquefies life into the cited ordeal of a dream within a dream. But the Rock-Piper-Miranda relationship is just as fluidly fated, being essentially a dreamtime tragedy of liquid essences that onerically coalesce into a poesque mise en abyme. For Hanging Rock dissolves Miranda into Poe's watery nightmare by luring her into its own dreaming of the piper. It is, however, at Miranda's unlatching of Hanging Rock Gate that the piper soars as the monolith's fluting fluidity, disintegrating kindred spirits into absent presences. For what Miranda unlatches is her initiation into non-being, a poetic dissolution of her Botticelli beauty into a dreamtime eternity, whose slow-motion swirling dissolves through superimpositions into the distorted perspective of birds dashing in antithetical directions. Ali's depiction of the aboriginal Neptune readily comes to mind, for its perspectival fluidity similarly makes, quote Ali, boundaries disappear and all sense of proportion fall apart at the seams. This is a seminal moment in Weir's elemental aesthetics. for its stunning synthesis of Hanging Rock's initial Labdus souls, heralds what Gilles Deleuze would describe as Weir's, and I'm quoting Deleuze, Cinema One, I believe, the movement image, transition from a mechanics of solids to a mechanics of fluids, a conversion to filmic liquidity that culminates in the Dreamtime deluge of the last wave, the film, the Australian film, he immediately directed after Picnic at Hanging Rock. Equally crucial, however, is that what renders this sequence eerily disturbing is the feeling that its disorienting, dissolving images signify a spectral speciality resonating with the dissolution of its phantom piping. Not surprisingly, Greg Bell, Picnic's sound supervisor, actually confirms that such soundtrack sophistication, quote, all flows from Peter, unquote. For Weir's sound thinking distinguishes him as one of those filmmakers whom Michel Chion, whom I have already quoted, the great French film theorist, who specializes in film sound. And Chion labels visualists of the ear, filmmakers who, quoting Chion, create a veritable intersensory reciprocity by injecting into the image a sense of the auditory. The gate sequence poignantly exemplifies Weir's transsensorial filmic vision by onerically visualizing the Rock Piper spectralization of Miranda's poetic fluidity into Dreamtime's melting music. Nothing of comparable musical spectrality haunts Weir's source fiction. For Lindsay's Picnic, like Cliff Green's adapted film script, lacks Weir's pivotal notion of a poesque Miranda dissolving into a Dreamtime Piper's fluting. But Weir still owes Lindsay her Dreamtime motif of spectral speciality. Consider, for instance, how Lindsay's Hanging Rock intrigues the schoolgirls by appearing and disappearing with every turn of the road. And I was quoting, of course, Lindsay there. Or indeed, how it looms in Michael and Albert's eyes, quoting Lindsay, floating in splendid isolation on a sea of pale grass. But Lindsay's impressionistic rendition of Hanging Rock speaks, wavering in a Heidelberg sky with heat, never attains the demonesque liminal liquidity of Weir's constantly dissolving monolith. Nor does Green's Rock, for it only liquefies when it sails into the young man's vision in the screenplay's parallel sequence. Green's Rock shares, however, with Lindsay's the Dreamtime essence of being absently present, for it likewise fascinates the drag-driven schoolgirls as it keeps appearing fleetingly between moving trees. And of course, I'm quoting Lindsay again here. Yet what the Lindsay Green Miranda unleashes at Hanging Rock Gate is just a flock of parrots whose ominous screeching affects no spatial shifting. But this Dreamtime phenomenon later recurs on Lindsay's rock plane when, by rapidly intercutting four landscape details filtered through the imagined viewpoints of her four schoolgirls, Lindsay creates a collage of whirling perspectives that collapses into spatial disorientation. At no time, however, does Lindsay connect this weird effect with the, quote, far-off drums, unquote, that Irma hears. Lindsay's Picnic harbors the fluidity of no musical phantom. Nor does Green's screenplay, for it heightens the weirdness of Lindsay's dizzying perspectives with deafening cicada shrilling, but not with the distant drumming. The drum's uncanny potential remains tantalizingly undetermined, for no musical manifestation underscores in the Lindsay Green texts the subsequent disappearance of Miranda, Irma, Marion, or for that matter of Miss Macro, the mathematics teacher, who also disappears on the rock. Quite rightly, Brian McFarlane finds the, quote, thematic and tonal coherence, unquote, of Weir's Picnic lacking in both Green and Lindsay. For Weir transcends their Dreamtime rock plane sequence by imbuing it with his opening rock gate vision of auditory dissolution. Rather than developing Green's suggestion, for instance, quote Green, to blend the cicadas and Edith screaming into an inextricable nightmare, unquote, where pitches the girl's screams to a guttural growl whose non-diegetic synthesized resonance intensifies the dreamtime terror of being out of synchronization with the natural environment. Dreamtime, eh? So do the non-diegetic noises that we create by reversing recorded earthquake vibrations, for their thunder-like effect seemingly emanates from a stormy spectral plane. Weir's dreamtime threat is far more disorienting than that of his literary sources, for it manifests in terms of spatially disjointed sound effects rather than from ominous natural noises such as greens, buzzing blowflies, or Lindsay's gurgling magpies. Again, what Weir pits against Lindsay's sudden flurry of wind sending a long shiver through the Virginia creeper, unquote, is the chilling wind-like draft on the monolith's windless heights. Weir's Hanging Rock is, to use Sean's term, an acousmetic or phantom territory, for Weir unhinges its auditory dimension from its climactic condition. Annabel Carr cogently observes that Weir patterns these bizarre noises on the disorienting sound of that earlier Outback masterpiece, Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout, the film that really created the Australian cinema. And Roeg was, of course, the famous 60s, early 70s British cinematographer. More eerily suggestive of Dreamtime's incongruous bearings are, however, electronic ambient noises that evoke the rock piper's liquefying fluting by sounding like the whooshing of a seashell ocean. At one point, in fact, these liquid noises seemingly dissolve into the ghostly piping that suddenly erupts into their silence. What resonates within these auditory apparitions is evidently the rock's dreamtime liquidity that the piper piercingly catalyzes into Miranda and Irma's fluid dancing. This is accentuated by the recurrence of those dissolving devices Weir employs when Miranda unlatches Hanging Rock Gate, a succession of superimpositions, melting images of the girls floating in antithetical slow motion swirling. This is dreamtime's fluidity at its deadliest, or what Ali terms the daytime-dreamtime overlap, whereby the girls flutingly melt into dream bodies of their physical waking selves. Miranda's proleptic statement to Sarah, "I won't be here much longer," finds in this metamorphic moment the fulfillment of her post-citation with his implied death wish by oneiric liquefaction. For as Gaston Bachelard points out, quote, "Imagined water in Poe has all the traits of life drawn towards death, of the life wanting to die," unquote. But just as Miranda dissolves into the gargled rock, so does Irma disperse into three contiguous shades that fade into the rock's terrain. Only Edith is spared, for Marion embraces her other schoolmate's slow motion exit. Weir's vision of the rock piper liquefying the Appleyard girls into Dreamtime's imponderable realm parallels Joanna Lambert's description of the aboriginal, quote, "dreaming self floating in a world beyond the rational," unquote. What makes Weir's picnic so unsettling is precisely its Dreamtime irrationality. For nothing really explains what motivates the rock piper to liquefy Irma, Marion, and presumably even Ms. McCraw, but not Edith, into Miranda's equally perplexing, poesque death dream. Again, to ask why only Irma returns from her dreamtime self is like asking why in The Birds, which Hitchcock pivots on a similar spectral soundtrack, Melanie Daniels responds to the deadly flapping wings by climbing alone to the attic, as Mr. Whitehead, the Appleyard gardener, intuits. Some questions got answers and some haven't. What clearly intrigues Weir is the insoluble, for he himself declares, quote, "I did everything in my power to hypnotize the audience away from the possibility of solutions," unquote. Significantly, Weir's response to Michael's question to Miss Leopold, "Emma, what happened on the rock?" is to liquefy us on the spot. For Weir instinctively dissolves from the couple's old pond to what Green calls the haunted lake, thereby immersing us into Irma's lethal fate, the antithetical stream of oblivion's memory. Picnic is a dreamtime mystery that is as unfathomably fluid as the last wave's apocalyptic deluge. For crucial to Picnic's mystery is the illogicality of what Hartigan calls the film's, quote, fluid unreality, unquote. A dreamtime liquiescence that flutingly flows through every aspect of Weir's alluring soundtrack. Consider, for instance, how Weir spectralizes Michael's vision of Miranda as a swan apparition by infusing his Lake Sequence's Beethoven music with the liquefying threat of the rock piper's fluting dirge. That Ed Rodzinski should find Weir's inclusion of Beethoven's fifth piano concerto reassuring, and these are Rodzinski's word, is in fact rather surprising. Deadly accurate, however, is Jonathan Rayner's comment, quote, the emperor music, rather than asserting the primacy of Victorian order, conveys more of an elegiac tone for the society's vulnerable state, unquote. For what really concerns Weir is the vulnerability of the visionary Michael, a vulnerability that the concerto's second movement plangently underscores by imbuing Michael's swan vision with what Arthur Jacobs describes as the piano's, this is his phrase, rippling figures. Hence Weir's rack-focusing effect that, by alternately shifting Michael and Miranda's focal planes, propels them into dreamtime's fluid realm, where they mutually sharpen and blur. But what Michael's rack-focused fluidity suggests is that falling in love with this one Miranda is like dissolving into her insubstantial substance. Weir's inspired cut to the swanless pond clinches the dreamtime frisson. As Rayner astutely senses, the adagio is mournfully menacing, for its non-diegetic spectral ripples are but variants of the rock piper's dissolving flutings. Significantly, Weir revisions the schoolgirl's outset to Hanging Rock by a slow-motion flashback that replaces the earlier sequence's luring piping with the same Beethoven movement. But the rock piper still lurks within Beethoven's adagio strains. For what the flashback's floating girls, and particularly the evanescing Miranda's farewell to Mamselle de Poitiers, disturbingly connote, is the spectral liquidity in the adagio's rippling soul. Equally attesting to the piper's appropriating presence is what happens to Michael when the fluting takes over from Bruce Smeaton's swelling music during his rock search for the vanished Appleyard students. This is clearly a dreamtime fluid appropriation, for what the fluting leaves in its wake is Michael's oneric vision of the girls dissolving with Miranda in a slow motion dreaming of her poetic liquefying death wish. Like Michael's bedroom vision of a swan that flutingly dissolves into Miranda dissolving into the rock, Michael's rock nightmare confirms that these are musical manifestations of dreamtime's melting threat. Seeping through Weir's Picnic is dreamtime's musical fluidity that never underscores the Lindsay Green Miranda's metamorphosis into a swan. For their metamorphic moment incurs no liquid dissolution. Indeed, Lindsay's Ovidian description lacks the ethereal fluidity of Weir's filmic transmutation. And I'm going to quote Lindsay. Michael was almost within touching distance of her muslin skirts when they became the faintly quivering wings of a white swan. Nor do such liquid details as Lindsay's sparkling jet or Green's tinkling of falling water resonate in any spectral way. Admittedly, Lindsay describes Michael's rock nightmare as a drowning dream, but she never develops this watery dream's musical box, haunting the suffocating Michael with its tinkling voice, into a musical equivalent to Weir's ontology of flutings, underscoring his Miranda's avian apotheosis. What Weir retains from Lindsay's vision of Miranda's swan apparitions is the intense sense of loss in Michael's longing for the willow swan. For as Anne Crittenden rightly notes, the filmic Michael's swan visions, quote, have pathos and beauty, but offer no hope, unquote. Ian Hunter's notion that, quote, landscape doesn't embody time and space but myth, unquote, finds its most exquisite expression in Michael's Orphic ordeal, where his swan Eurydice flutters beyond his reach in a dreamtime reverie. For Miranda, lured by the piper's seductive fluting, crosses Macedon Creek in slow motion, thereby dissolving into dreamtime's poet's quarters, that never, never netherworld of Macfarlane's nameless dread. Reaching for Miranda is like touching the spectral fluidity of nothing. Where's Miranda transcends even the Derridean state of being, quoting, of course, Derrida, nothing visible. For by dissolving Miranda, Pied Piper-like, into a fluting adagio of loss, the rock piper spectralizes her into an inaudible swan song. Inaudibility is of the essence in Weir's dreamtime landscape. For if pan pipes are deadly, deadlier still is their silence. That is, of course, a rephrasing of what Kafka says about mermaids. Deadly is the mermaid song, deadlier still is their silence. Credit where it is due. I couldn't have invented that. Hence picnic's white noise soundtrack. White noise is an expression used by Weir himself that Weir paradoxically defines as a realm of silent sounds. Quoting Weir, sounds that are inaudible to the human ear but are constantly there on the track. The Appleyard schoolgirl's ascent of Hanging Rock offers an unnerving example. For rumbling subliminally beyond Smeaton's swelling orchestra and choir are synthesized earthquakes that Weir slows down to the liminal level of Hitchcock's low hum in the bird's final sequence. Significantly, just as Hitchcock's humming silence shrieks an avian menace, so does Weir's silent rumble echo the lethal piping. Of crucial importance in this context are Russell Boyd's strategic pan shots. For true to Stephanie Gopier's observation that, quote, the resonance of the quaking disturbs the optical, unquote, Boyd's panning camera conveys the disorienting spatial shifting that the rock piper's fluting effects in the schoolgirl's perception. What rumbles is evidently the dreamtime troubadour's silent piping. As Sion contends, these are his words, of course, silence is never a neutral emptiness. Profound words. Significantly, again, I couldn't have thought of that, of course. Significantly, what underscores the ominous stopping of the picnickers' fob watches at 12 o'clock is something more orally annihilating, the rock piper's non-rumbling, fluting silence. As Richard von Busick suggests, Weir's, these are his words, high noon is as haunted as midnight. For the result is this quietly magical, a midsummer midday's musical stillness that imbues the picnickers with the non-ticking essence of what Gopher terms aboriginal tribal timelessness. As Miranda cryptically says, everything begins and ends at exactly the right time and place. At no time does Mrs. Appleyard's constantly ticking clock prove Miranda wrong, for it suddenly stops to herald its owner's reenactment on Hanging Rock of Sarah's equally fatal fall. Hence Miranda's rejection of her precious diamond watch, for Hanging Rock likewise initiates her into its dreamtime zone, where time literally stops. This is thematically in keeping with Lindsay's dreamtime description of the rock's temporarily unbounded dimension. And I'm going to quote, of course, Joan Lindsay. At the Hanging Rock, the first gray light is carving out the slabs and pinnacles of its eastern face. Or perhaps it is sunset. Like a timeless Marienbad of the outback, Lindsay's rock's dawn kindles its twilight, a dreamtime phenomenon that Weir parallels through the equally oxymoronic dissolution of the piper's silent fluting. An eerier picnic instance is that of the black bloodhound barking unaccountably at what remains tantalizingly inapparent and inaudible. What distinguishes this rock sequence is its lack of any visual liquefaction and or auditory distortion, a stylistic variation that, rather than disrupting, heightens the weirdness of the bloodhound's unmotivated barking. A tentative answer to Green's disturbing question, but at what does the bloodhound suddenly growl and bristle, is that Weir's bloodhound uncannily barks at nothing, of course with a capital N in the Derridean sense. For Weir plunges us once more into what is and yet is not. Significantly, Weir pivots the futile search on Beethoven's Adagio's opening bars that lack any piano rippling, an echoing harmony with the total cessation of the piper's fluid fluting. In Derridean terms, nothing audible becomes nothing inaudible. As Weir himself states, it's within a lot of the silences that I tell my side of the story. Weir achieves, in fact, his stated aim of, quote, unlocking his ghosts through Lindsay's by spectralizing the latter into a Derridean absent presence, proleptic of Derrida's vision of specters as, again, of course, from specters of Marx, being always there, even if they do not exist, even if they are no longer, even if they are not yet. Weir's bloodhound sequence dissolves the rock piper into the zero-degree essence of soundscape phantomness. The quote, elements of elegy, of loss and mourning, unquote, that Jack Lancey finds in Beethoven's accompanying slow movement, attest to the rock piper's nothingness, just as the musical recurrence at Miranda's final freeze frame celebrates her eternal evanescence. Weir's picnic revisions what Kirkby labels Lindsay's Wordsworthian ghostly language. Those are Kirkby's words, ghostly language, by incarnating it in Hanging Rock's musical dreaming of the nothingness of being. John Sittibitz hits Dreamtime's non-existent nail on its head when he states that picnic, quote, decelerates into an unambiguous silence and stasis at the end, as if veils had been drawn away, revealing finally nothing but a blank slate, unquote. What picnic offers is only a mystery to the solution. Consequently, one would somehow diminish its alluring uncertainty by interpreting it exclusively, as I have done, in terms of the Gopier Ali Lambert vision of a metamorphosizing aboriginal dream body. Too many roads lead towards Hanging Rock, and like other possible Dreamtime, or for that matter, non-Dreamtime incursions, the Gopier Ali Lambert part is arguably a cul-de-sac, albeit one that thrives on the elusive fluidity of Hanging Rock's grounds. Still, no definite interpretation is possible. For as Rainer stresses, Picnic asserts the presence of the unknown and the unattainable in its unclosed narrative, unquote. To scale Weir's Hanging Rock is like entering T.S. Eliot's Chapel Perilous to confront, and of course I'm using Eliot's words, only the wind's home. Picnic at Hanging Rock is a filmic bush ballad of the void, for what Weir's piper fluting the chants is Le Fluide de Néon, to go back, of course, to Derrida and Hume. That was it. It was difficult, very difficult, because I had tutored Carla on Weir. And she wrote extremely well on both Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave. But this always happens to me. Huh? At the present moment, I'm struggling with Mario Aquilina's thesis. And what, again, he wrote brilliantly on La Chute de la Maison Echelle by Epstein. Because I have to take, to go off tangent from what I have told to the children, what of course they have, I owe lots of things to Carla. For instance, she looked for things on the internet, the Lambert, the Ali articles, you gave them to me. So again, credit where it's due. But it's not easy. When you have good students, and they do an extremely good job, how are you going to better that good job? But I always take that as a challenge, Pete. I mean, as I told some of my students, and as I believe I told Carla's boyfriend a few weeks ago, I could do it, I think, because when I was tutoring Carla, was that perhaps 10 years ago, 7? I hadn't yet realized something which so far as I know, and my knowledge is very limited. Nobody has ever conceived of the piper as a Sionesque akuzmet, as a phantom piper, as not only a character in its own right, but as perhaps the most important character in this film. At that time, I hadn't conceived any notion of it, Carla. Believe me. What made me realize it, I mean, you forced me to realize it, because I can't just copy what Carla produced and got a degree for, partially, of course. But everybody said what a fine dissertation it was, eh? At that time, including examiners like the external examiner, Father Joe Borch. They all liked the piece. They thought it was extremely well written. And I have to admit again that I found it very hard to try to do it. But this is what, of course, I think you can have it, Carla. You deserve it.
Salvin, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a fascinating discussion of what must be one of the most mysterious films ever produced, both in terms of its content and in terms of the effect I think it has on us as an audience. So let's open the floor to any questions that people wish to ask about Salvo's interpretation.
One of many. In fact, I believe that Literature from Quarterly sent it to Professor Ray McFarlane. And I had talked with Professor McFarlane about the film. And we disagreed completely. I got the reader's report. Eh? He accepted it. Even though he says, I don't know whether it's the same professor, but he is definitely the Literature Film Quarterly expert on Australian cinema. He wrote a monograph on Peter Weir. And he also included Picnic at Hanging Rock on a very important book of his about film adaptations, Australian novels adapted to film. We have it in our main library here at the University of Malta Library.
Let me just open up with a possible question.
But it's, as you said, one interpretation out of two many possible ones.
My question is, to what extent are you fundamentally concerned with an interpretation of Peter Weir's film, or the interpretation of Peter Weir's film? To what extent are you perhaps rather using his film as a prop for speculation on the whole issue of nothingness, on the whole issue of the void?
Yes, undoubtedly so. That is totally undeniable. I am. That's what I'm interested in.
One point I take very, very strongly from your talk, Xavier, is your highlighting of the acoustic element in the film and the extent to which this film, more than most, conveys whatever message it has through an incredible blending of the visual and the oral. And this just happens to be of great interest to anthropologists nowadays who are often arguing that in perceiving reality or in trying to interpret reality, we privilege the visual. Whereas what's going on in your interpretation of Picnic at Hanging Rock is that you're giving at least as much weight to the acoustic, to the oral, as you are to the visual.
Again, that is also undoubtedly true. What Professor Clough is telling us, I came to realize what he is saying, again, quite late. I don't want to give anyone present here the impression that, like Professor Mayo, I have written too many papers. But so far, I believe I must have written 17 two of which have not been published or accepted to be published yet. Suddenly, I was talking to Anita, who always types these papers for me. And I told her, you know what, Anita? And she said, what? I told her, why am I so much interested in the interaction of sight and sound? Another preoccupation, again with nothingness, is the paper I've written on Bresson's Lancelot du Lac. Why everything is pivoted on the hollow clanking of the Bressonian Camelot, the knights. Why, for me, the birds, which is also, of course, a film dealing, as I said, with respect to the sound lack, has always meant so much to me. I know that Psycho is a much greater movie. Yet, though I still say that Vertigo is Hitchcock's greatest masterpiece, after Vertigo, I would definitely rate The Birds. But that's a very personal choice. But that ties up with your observation, Paul, definitely. I'm very much immersed in this limbo.
Xavier, I was very fascinated, despite being interrupted with some urgent calls, family related.
I'm very honored that you are here today.
But I mean, in your arm, was in this field. I haven't watched the film. So that's one confession. So the one who writes a lot of papers is going to ask the most stupid question, which is the visual. Okay, I'm fascinated by, you're very much into Derrida. I did not associate that from my knowing you, but particularly your reference to the Chapel Perilous.
Yes.
And of course, it brings out the whole idea of the quest for the Holy Grail. Yeah. So maybe you want to comment in terms of the link there. And my second question, I'll shut up, is the visual. Uh-huh. And from what I saw there and what I'm seeing right now, to what extent is French painting?
That's why I mentioned the Heidelberg School.
Because that reminds me of Renoir and the others.
Yes.
And it's so the shot I'm talking about, but I had that sense seeing it.
Yes, you're...
So there I am.
The professor who has written a lot of papers did not ask a stupid question at all. In fact, when I was comparing Lindsay's Heidelberg school effect, pictorially speaking, to Weir's, I said that in Weir we have a Monet-esque liquidity.
Monet.
The Monet of the, of course, of the water lilies.
I heard that.
Yes, yes, yes. No, it's not
asked.
It's not stupid at all.
That's what it is.
So it's not not just the acoustic that dissolves. It's not just acoustic dissolving, but it's also visual dissolving as well.
The Chapel Perilous. Only the wind's home. You hear the wind. Can you touch it? Yes, I'm obsessed with these things, very much so. For instance, if you're making me go back to what I said about Kurosawa, the paper I wrote on the Japanese Macbeth. Why so much mist in the film? Because you can see the mist. Try to grab it. Kurosawa's incredibly creative, inspired, and inspiring visual analogy to Shakespeare's Hollow Crown. And of course, to that great speech. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day till the last silver recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. This is the walking shadow. A poor player that struts and fretters out upon the stage and then is heard no more. Dusty death. The texture had to be that of the dusty death, of the walking shadow. The substance is in the shadow, as in expressionistic cinema, as in Murnau's Nosferatu. Again, Murnau had a parallel problem. How is he going to show the nothingness of Stoker's Dracula? When one of the sailors on the Demeter tells us that he actually made his knife go into this very odd, thin-looking, pale creature coming always at night, of course, on the deck of the ship. He tells us that he was very, very much terrified because his knife went right through him. And Jonathan Harker actually sees things through Stoker's Dracula. Murnau could only go against traditional vampire law, where we have always been taught that vampires don't cast a shadow. His Nosferatu, his Dracula, had to cast a shadow. That's how he analogizes visually. Because Nosferatu is a 1921, 1922 attempt by a German filmmaker to make a film on nothing, on nothingness. It is not a coincidence that a few years later, Heidegger wrote Being and Time.
A few years after?
After Nosferatu. Yes. Not a coincidence that so many law-abiding citizens cried, this is Steiner, not Salvo Catania, during Steiner, thanks to Paolo, I owe so much, practically everything, to so many people. Paul Spiteri. When he said, how could these law-abiding family men and family women cry during a performance of Romeo and Juliet when Romeo commits the Romeo error? And then, very, very early next morning, they go back to the concentration camps to continue exterminating human beings. The philosophy of what I have just said is the nothingness of being. They believed, literally believed, most of them at least, or George Stein has convinced me that they did, that they were exterminating the nothingness of being, the dirt of the nothingness of being. Was it Primo Levi who once said that the Jews' greatest enemies were the Jews? The German upper middle class Jews, at first, in fact, and Paul Spiteri actually told me this, and I rely very much on him, approved of what was happening in German ghettos, because they are giving us a bad name.
Well, with respect to Picnic at Hanging Rock, It's interesting that the theme of nothingness, which you're, I think, very interestingly and possibly rightly making central to the meaning of the film, nothingness is as difficult to approach as solid solid objects are. I mean, there's a whole philosophy on the inaccessibility of the thing in itself. You can go back to Kant and talk about the thing in itself as opposed to the various optical or other sensations we have of the thing in itself. But the point here is that just as things are capable of being remote, so too nothingness itself is very difficult to apprehend. And so you're suggesting to us that what Weir is doing is he's approaching the nothingness through the notions of dissolution, the idea of liquefaction, the idea of things becoming less solid, the idea of melting. In other words, these are all ways in which you are trying to, as it were, make contact with nothingness through the film's images. So, by definition, nothing cannot be described, but it is nevertheless necessary, you, Salvo, seem to be saying, it's nevertheless for us to somehow approach this concept. And you're saying that Weir does this through things like fluidity,
dissolution, liquefy.
Nothing in life was really watertight. That's why I opted for that epigraph.
But may I just ask a question at a tangent to this? I think a lot of us who saw the film, and I saw it once many, many years ago, and never forget it, came away, obviously, well, I came away confused. But I think to any contemporary audience, one might almost want to say any modernist audience, surely one has to look also at the Freudian side of the film. I mean, it's fairly upfront. Now, is this Weir's, I can't think of the word quickly in English, is this Weir's a shadow play? Is he trying to put up a mask in front of us which we have to tear away?
Maybe.
Is this not really significant? It's really a trope to almost make us to disguise his concern with nothingness? Or is it rather central to the play? Because surely the dreaminess of the girl, the strange seeming rapport between the boy and the girl, the theme of puberty, the theme of adolescence, it all seems too strongly, closely connected with Freudian notions of the sexual in the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. What would you say about this? Is this significance? If it is, how does it relate to your theme of nothingness?
Weir has repeatedly denied what, and this is where, in fact, I believe Professor McFadden and I went our separate ways, drifted apart, to keep to the to how I interpreted Picnic, to the metaphors through which I have interpreted Picnic. We drifted apart. Weir has consistently denied that he was interested in the girl's sexuality. Though I can see your point. It is there. I don't think that is, one can hardly deny that. Again, any one of you could have quoted out to me D.H. Lawrence, trust the tale and not the teller. And this is why I believe I had to let it, again, if you allow me to use a liquid verb, to let it seep in through pen. This is how I would answer your seminal question, Paul.
So you're kind of, I don't want to go further than I know, but you're suggesting almost the idea of the little death, which occurs in sex,
yes,
as the,
yes,
little,
yes,
death,
yes, yes,
which occurs in French
modern
philosophy. It's an intimation. Sex is an intimation,
yes,
of dissolution. It's an intimation of death.
But the way he goes about mythologizing it, it's beauty. Again, this is a very personal problem. My intensely personal problem have always been public problems. I discussed it with my students. I remember once having a look with a close friend of mine, Noah. Stephen would, of course, does know this friend of mine. And we went to have a look at Cocoon. And I was very much taken in by a sequence where someone is spying on a couple of teenage couple, I believe so, a voyeur. The way, who directed it, by the way, Ron Howard, I believe. The one who directed Mermaid. He really transforms what I was expecting, a cliched sequence, into something which really attracted me. Because it's an alien couple. And they do not have sex as we do, human beings. What they did was throw shafts of light into each other's bodies. And suddenly, I turned upon Noel, and I told him, what an enchanting way to make sex, to have sex with another human being. And he sensed it in my tone. I told him, the way we go about it, it's so messy. It's so frustrating physically. That's why we call it the battle of the sexes. It can be literally bloody. And so on and so forth. And Noel, although he's not an academic, he's a very intelligent man, said nothing. Then when I stopped, a monologue, a Salvo Catania monologue, celebrating the etherealization of sexuality. This explains everything with respect to how, why, and how, why I was attracted to Picnic at Hanging Rock, and why I wrote, and how I wrote what I wrote. He said, Salvo, I don't disagree on anything on what you have just told me. Yes, ours is messy, very pathetic, comparatively speaking. But that's what I would like to stick to, Salvo.
I'd like to add an observation of this, but as a very old student of Salvo Catania's, my area of interest is in pictorial art.
Yes.
And at the moment I'm grappling with the problem of talking about art in words. We can only explain art in words.
Right.
And you've constantly brought up metaphors, if you like, for this problem, unbeknownst to you, but this is what I've picked up. This idea of not being able to... the metaphor of water, you know. It's a presence, but it has no shape. Epithet you mentioned about watertight. Water just slips through your hands. You can try to cup it, but it has no shape itself. But even Paul mentioned this marriage, if you like, of the visual with the acoustic.
Yes.
Again, two different media. Yeah. One is fairly still, the other needs time. And it occurred to me that perhaps Peter Weir's Picnic at Hanging Rock is in itself a sort of metaphor for this problem that he is explaining pictorially, or visually at least.
Yes.
This idea of occupying space and this idea of now transition into a space that you may go into it, but you can't come back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like puberty. There are these instances of transitions, of changing over in a way that is irreversible. But then on the other hand, you have the paradox of dream time. You can get back into a state where you are not dreaming, in the sense that you are awake. It also occurred to me that...
This might account. You see how much I learned? Why Irma comes back.
Yes. Yes. And yet there is more to it than all that human beings are capable of perceiving. It's not just art that is communicated to knowing human beings, because even the bloodhound senses a presence. Even the birds express that presence with their movements. So there is something. What I like about the knowingness is the ness at the end of it, the something with the nothing. Is it a metaphor or is it itself the art? Peter Weir's Hanging Rock. My only other familiarity with Peter Weir's work is Fearless, where again he explores this theme of an alternative form of being.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the difficulty presented by this person who came back, or this group of persons who came back, that difficulty with adjustment, these living two parallel universes in one body.
Having survived that crash.
Yes.
He changed.
Yes.
The air crash metamorphosizes him into something still seemingly human and yet not.
So this is a very interesting problem that Peter Weir is grappling with. It's a problem that's faced across other artistic forms. But thank you. It's been a most
interesting
talk.
No, I should thank you for giving me that hint about Irma.
May I ask another question? The dream time. Why do you see the Australian dream time as significant? In what way? Surely the film makes sense in terms of your overall interpretation, which is hinting at or suggesting some link between liquefaction or dissolution or fluidity and an approach to nothingness, which is both frightening and very, very, very suggestive. But why does it mean it needs to be connected with the Australian Aboriginal dream time? That's my question.
I always tell, again, a very intriguing question. I always tell my students, my first-year students, development of film language students, what are film actors? Of course, nobody, for some reason or other, perhaps they're scared, does hazard an answer. And I always refer, Paul, these film students, to something I read in Bianco e Nero. Bianco e Nero is the official journal of the Italian Film School. It must be an early 60s or at the very latest mid-60s interview with Michelangelo Antonioni, the great Italian filmmaker. And Michelangelo Antonioni is discussing film problems with this Italian film critic, whoever he was. And he is telling this film critic at one point, he tells this film critic at one point, Michelangelo Antonioni, he tells him, if I'm filming a love scene, a couple making love to each other, I can't deal with a couple. It won't work on film. And I keep, of course, asking my students, what the hell is he fishing for? What does he imply? Not even the critic got to it, eh? And he tells him, film actors are figures in a landscape. Where I decide to make or to shoot the love scene is going to determine the essence of the love between these two characters. Why under a table? Where is the table? The color of the table, the shape, the age. Is it a very expensive piece of furniture? Under a tree, wherever. I'm dealing with a menage a trois. To this enormous extent is landscape significant in film. The landscape is the externalization of what we cannot, of course, x-ray. Human emotions, human feelings. The outback is the, and that's why I said the piper is the rock's piper. Without the rock, there is no real film. When do I tell these things to the first year students? When we are doing the Lumiere Brothers. Kenneth, of course, knows, most probably you remember, because I show them Bateau Sortant du Port, the boat leaving the harbor. And I tell them, what's filmic here? The camera aesthetic? What's so crucial? Why are so many expert, film scholars, film professors, haunted, especially those whose expertise is silent film. But this Lumiere short. Is it because of the Tennysonian resonances about crossing the bar? Because the boat, it shows us two women, I believe, and two girls on the jetty, and the boat is leaving the harbor. The moment the boat leaves, the goes beyond the jetty, the boat is caught in a swell, and the men in the boat have to contend with the waters. Otherwise, the boat will be capsized, and they will most probably drown. I told him that from the very beginning, film actors, even though those were not really actors, are figures in a landscape. The landscape takes over, in this case, the seascape. But this is not my insight. Eh? I repeat. And this is also what Professor Kalous told me. Because one of my ex-students claims that he is self-taught. And I actually discussed it, Professor Evan Kalous. And I told him, how many billions of people are on planet Earth? If all of them claim that they are self-taught, I will be the only one to say that I knew nothing. I learned everything from other people. And he said, would you kindly include me as well? This is Antonioni's insight. Had I not read these great filmmakers' books, the interviews they gave, the great film professors' books, I would know nothing about film, nothing. I learned from your thesis. I learned from her comment here. God knows what I learned from Stephen about narratology or from Paul's comments here. But I can't envisage a self-taught human being. Perhaps this is my limit, my limitation.
That
my
is a common myth today. You talk of the autonomous individual as if we are like...
I am not. I can never be. Yes. God knows what I owe to your wife when we used to discuss French literature, and I have forgotten. But I still have it in me.
Figures in a landscape, if I may. So I was discussing this with my students this morning. The transition from human beings as center of the universe, the Renaissance ideal, to the romantic notion, where nature takes over. How much of that is in what Antonio was saying?
Peter, of course, knows much more than I do.
Of course, we have deviated from the film.
No, we are not. I always tell my students, Paul, I can't lecture on film in a vacuum. I don't believe in that. Paradoxically, I am obsessed with it. When I handed my Vertigo paper to Professor Kalous, he came back to me. You missed this crucial marathon discussion. He was on sabbatical and he could afford it. And he meant to do it. He told me, we're going to accept your paper, Salvo. It's not about acceptance or non-acceptance. But I am querying something about your paper. As he is, and he has every right, and as everybody here has every right to query. Something which I'm querying about the paper I'm writing at the moment. Something on Hamlet. Act 5, Scene 1, the graveyard sequence. And he asked me this question, Professor Kalous. He told me, what moral or ethic right, I'm putting in my poor English compared to his petty words, I'm putting petty words in his mouth, but this was the gist. Do we have people like you and me to write as we are writing on nothingness? If it's nothingness, where are we finding this depth in this nothingness? And he pressed me for an answer. I couldn't answer. though I'm 60 years old. I came here when he was born. And he pressed, he came for an answer. And I told him, you are giving me the answer. What are you writing on? The grave digger scene. And suddenly Nietzsche came to my mind. I told him, hollowness is depth. Depth is hollowness. Have a look at that grave. Without hollowness, there's no depth. And he said, yes. And apart from Nietzsche, even more so, Schopenhauer, our knowledge of our own impending death has made us create something by which we will be remembered after our death. What gives us so much pleasure comes, according to Schopenhauer, from what terrifies us so much. Death. He says, I don't know whether they would need an art, immortal beings. Again, but I owe it to Schopenhauer. I was born a farm boy. And that's what I remain, basically. And that's where I would like to go back. But I can't, of course. That farm is no more, as in Dylan Thomas's poem, Fernhill. Now it belongs to a powerful Maltese millionaire. I can't go back to those fields. That's why I tell my students, I would like to go back to silence and peace. But how much I miss you all if I had to go back.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled The Piper at Hanging Rock Gate. This talk was delivered by Dr. Xavier Catania.